folks from USGS who we've been working together with on an interagency agreement to put together this training on fractured bedrock. We've had them deliver this training to three regions so far, all out on the East Coast. So now the Region 10 folks have requested that we bring it out here. And so we're happy to have this here. And this is also the first time that we've offered it as a live webinar. So we are also broadcasting this to other EPA folks and public folks who are interested in learning about this topic. So I want to thank everyone from the USGS who's involved, especially Claire Tiedemann. And thank you for coming out here and for helping put these presentations together. And also, big thanks to Ted Rapaski with Region 10, who was our lead for putting this together. And I want to thank Ted and his counterparts here and also his management for support. And also, last but not least, thanks to Gene Ballant for staying up late with us on the East Coast so that we can get this out to everybody. So now I would like to hand it over to Claire Tiedemann, say a few words, and we'll get started.
Okay, hello and welcome. I'm Claire Tiedemann. I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey office in Menlo Park, California, and I'm Cindy's counterpart on the interagency agreement that she mentioned between EPA and USGS for USGS to provide technical transfer of information about fate, transport, and contamination in fractured rocks to you guys at the EPA. And so in this introduction, I want to just give a little perspective and background about the work of the USGS participants in this workshop on fractured rock studies to help put in context some of the presentations that you're going to see by us today. So we've been working on fate and transport in fractured rocks for probably three decades or so. And we kind of have two categories of work in this area. One is some of us do what we call cooperative work with other governmental agencies where we conduct studies on contamination in fractured rocks that supports scientifically supports decision making that needs to be made by these other agencies, including the EPA in many parts of the country. And then we also conduct basic and applied research on fate and transport and remediation in fractured rocks. And the motivation for this research is ultimately to use it in applications for improving the decision-making process related to cleanup and management of contamination in fractured rocks. So we've been conducting this research at a couple of different sites over the past 30 years, and you're going to hear a lot about some of the results from those sites. One of those research sites is called Mirror Lake, and it's located in the central White Mountains of New Hampshire in crystalline rocks. We worked there in the 1980s and 1990s, and the focus there was really, it was an uncontaminated site, and the focus of that research was on developing field and analysis methods for being able to understand and characterize groundwater flow and chemical transport in fractured rocks, including a lot of geophysical methods development. And so then in the mid-2000s, around 2005, we moved to a research site in contaminated fractured rocks. And this site is the Naval Air Warfare Center located near Trenton, New Jersey, and this site is in dipping fractured mudstone. So we moved from a crystalline rock site to a sedimentary rock site for our research, and this site is highly contaminated with trichloroethylene as the main contaminant, and it's degraded biologically to other contaminants, DCE and vinyl chloride. So we've been working at this highly contaminated site with the research on contamination in fractured rocks. And again, this research, the overriding objective is aimed at ultimately helping with site management and remediation decisions. This research has a chloridated solvents focus, and it's in these sedimentary rocks. And we recognize that the geologic settings that we've worked in crystalline and sedimentary rocks, are different from a lot of your sites, which I understand are in basaltic rock. But we hope that our findings and our lessons learned are applicable to other fractured rock settings. I think Alan's going to talk a little bit about that in the next talk on general characteristics of fractured rock sites, such that studies in one type of geologic setting can be transferable to other geologic settings. There are four of us here from USGS that will be presenting, and I'll let my colleagues introduce themselves as they give their presentations. So I'll just end by saying thanks to the people in the room and on the webinar for attending this workshop, and we very much look forward to your questions from our presentations and any discussions that arise. We hope to have fruitful discussions rather than us just solely up here lecturing at you. So with that, I'll end, and thanks. And I guess we'll start with the first presentation by Alan. Ted? Oh, Ted. Yes, Ted. Ted comes up first. Okay. You're welcome.
Here you go.
Thank you. And as Gene mentioned, as we go along on this, we're pretty tight as far as our schedule. But if we have time between some of these presentations, we'll welcome questions. And then we also have some sessions in there for doing a whole question session at the end of it. And as also Claire mentioned, each presenter to come up, do a little brief introduction of themselves so we can move the thing along. I'm Ted Repaske, hydrogeologist here with EPA Region 10. And we appreciate the help with headquarters and USGS on putting together this workshop. So if we can start, we have the standard disclaimer that we've got throughout the presentation. All right. So fractured rock workshop, as we mentioned before. So the fractured rocks, some of the challenges we have is overall the fractured rocks are much more difficult to characterize than any of the normal, like, unconsolidated aquifers. The fractures may transmit the large quantities of water. For example, there are some sites in central Washington in the basalts that they're getting, like, 2,000 gallons a minute out of some of those wells. On the other hand, there's other areas that may be nearly impervious. Again, there's some areas in the Columbia River Basalt Group where they're so impervious that they've been proposed for using as high-level nuclear waste repository. Another challenge we have is a lot of times we have some sedimentary layers over top of these fracture systems, so the contaminants and such may move through those before they get into the fractured system. And our investigative approach can be very time-consuming and costly to try to determine what's going on in there. Additionally, we can get matrix diffusion that can cause retardation of some of our contaminant plume, and but they can yet have large volumes of mass within the rock matrix. And then also, aquifer restoration can be a challenging goal for many of our fractured rock sites. just throw this up here to, for people, especially like online, not familiar with EPA Region 10. We've got the four states, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And the orange up there was just some, I like this slide, but it's for a non-attainment of air quality back in 2006. A lot of the sites we have, for example, this is a geological map of Alaska showing that there's a lot of, the geology is accretion, where you have microcontinents colliding on and accreting on. And then additionally, we have a lot of volcanics in there. There's overall for Region 10, we have very little karsting in our geology, as opposed to some places like back east where there's much more of that karsting geology. And then as mentioned, sedimentary layers may overlie some of these rock environments. Here's just a zoomed in map of the Washington, Oregon, Idaho. Again, just showing you a little bit as far as the colors, that there's quite a bit as far as your igneous, metamorphic, and volcanic rocks in the area, and relatively little areas that are sedimentary rocks, such as along the coastal areas. Again, this is just Washington, again, showing where we've got a predominance of your metamorphic, igneous, and basaltic volcanics, rocks, and little, such as along around the Puget Sound, that might be glacial or sedimentary. Just as one example, here's a outline flow of just the Columbia River basalt group in those same three states. And as you can imagine, the fractures, joints, faults can tend to carry a lot of water in these. There's some pictures from Terry Tolan. I pulled these figures off of the USGS website. And then in addition to just surface contamination, additionally, we can have areas that have fractures and faults flowing along bedding planes in some mining environments. And these are some examples of up in Alaska, some in mining environments. So some issues that we have related to the for the whole fractured rock system is we have areas that have high rock in our Region 10, hard rock mining and various other geotechnical explorations. We're mining for metals as addition to some other hard rocks, quarries, that sort of thing. Some of these mines may generate seeps, mine discharges. In addition, they may have ponds and pits where you can get some water interacting. We also have technically sedimentary rocks, such as your coal and phosphate mining, that also can fracture up. We have in southeastern Idaho, for example, some of the phosphate mines have some very distinct faulting and fracturing that can distinctly change the groundwater levels on opposite sides of some of those. Then, as mentioned before, we have alluvial, loess, and glacial deposits over some of these fractured rock systems. It's complicated by folding and faulting, and we have a significant amount of groundwater surface water interaction. In addition to mining and everything, we also have various industrial, military, commercial contamination over these sites. So we have both for contamination and mining activities have influenced our contamination within these fracture systems. So for this course, day one is going to focus on characterization, and we will start off with characterizing the fate transport and remediation of the contaminants. We'll go on there to, Terry will talk about the basalts and other hard rock types in our Region 10. We'll have an introduction to our various geophysical methods used for the fracture rocks. Terry will again talk about the fracture rock drilling methods. And then we'll talk about borehole geophysics for the fracture rocks. And after lunch, we'll go into profiling the transmissivity and contaminants in the fractures that may intersect a borehole. Claire will give that. We'll do a selection, design, construction of a multi-level groundwater monitoring system in the bedrocks. Tim will talk a little bit about that. We'll do an overview of sampling methods for bedrock monitoring wells, and then we'll characterizing contaminant mass in the rock matrix. There will be an early stage conceptual site model as a case example that for Formosa mine. And then finally, at the end of the day, groundwater flow paths over a large volume of rocks, looking at cross-hole hydraulic testing. Tomorrow, we'll wrap up of the characterization with two presentations. There's design of the tracer test for site characterization and characterization of fracture rock systems for Red Devil Mine. That's, again, a case study. Then we're going to go into remediation for the presentations. So the role, we'll start off with role of numerical modeling in remedy selection and remedial performance. Characterization and treatment of a DNAPL source in a fracture rock. Then we'll do bioaugmentation in fractured rocks, again a case study. Assessing abiotic dechlorination in rock matrix. After lunch, we'll go into thermal remediation of fractured rocks, and then both natural attenuation and chemical attenuation in the fractured bedrock system. And then at the end of the day, we'll have another case study, GEF Viewmaster site, which is located in Oregon. It's within the Columbia River basalts. And then the final talk will be current research on the fate, transport, remediation, and management of contaminant fractured rocks. So if there's not any other questions,
nuclear repository program in the late 70s and through the 80s, where we were basically trying to figure out whether or not you could build a civilian fuel rod repository in the Columbia basalt about 3,000 feet underground. And actually what we learned from that drug me into hydrogeology, people trying to get water out of the basalt since, in fact, the Columbia Basalt forms a major regional aquifer system in Oregon, Washington, and western Idaho. So moving right along, what I'm going to do is Ted asked me to give kind of a high-level presentation on the regional geology, and this will be focused exclusively on Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And we'll move in and just have the a geologic map showing this area. The big thing about this is, boy, there's a lot of colors and a lot of lines. The black lines are faults. A lot of things are going on. Part of it here is we've got subduction going on along the coast here. We've got a mid-ocean ridge, which isn't in the middle of the ocean. It's being subducted. What's going on here in the Northwest is we've got a very long, complex tectonic history. A lot of what we're seeing here is, as been previously mentioned, Ted was talking about, was accreted terrains. That's how the western margin of North America grew since basically pre-Cambrian time. We've had chunks of oceanic islands, small slivers of continental material accreted, and our shoreline is growing westward. Matter of fact, the last piece that got accreted was about 38 million years ago, which was a piece of oceanic crust and oceanic islands, all basalt, basically. We've also got, subduction volcanism going on now, and as far back as we can look, back to late Mesozoic time, we've got accreted arcs, volcanic arcs, things like that. Currently, we've got the Cascade Range, which is the current iteration of subduction volcanism up through here. Pretty soon, they argue about probably in the next few million years, maybe 5 million years, our subduction zone out here, the Cascadia subduction zone, will lock up, because what's happening now is we're subducting very young, very light, buoyant oceanic crust under North America. It doesn't want to be subducted. It's basically attaching to the bottom of the slab, North America. And eventually it'll lock up, and a new subduction zone will form outbound of where the ridge is today. And we'll have a new volcanic arc probably occurring about where the shoreline of Oregon and Washington is today. So if it doesn't disappear totally and we get the connection of basically the San Andreas and the Queen Charlotte through here. The other thing we've got going on for the folks over here in western Idaho is the track of the Yellowstone hotspot, which is producing both basalt and more felsic rocks, rhyolitic eruptions, a lot of caldera eruptions. Interesting thing is people have a hard time tracking this hotspot into this area. It looks like it basically formed in southeastern Oregon, western Idaho, Nevada, and moved off from there. That's a whole different story. But and then on top of everything else that we've got going on here, we've got a lot of sedimentation going on since the middle Miocene time. So we've got a lot of sedimentary basins. So we've got sedimentary rocks on top of the hard rock. And just to make things even more complicated, as our subduction zone ridge trench collision is going on, we have broad regional uplift, which started up in BC and down in California and has been migrating basically towards where the Columbia River, Astoria, Oregon area. And in the last 3 million years, we've had up in the Cascade Range, like where the Columbia River Gorge is, we've had over 4,000 feet of uplift. In the Portland area, this area here, Puget Sound, we're looking at between 200 to 400 feet. You get east of the Cascade Range, about a similar order. If you ever look at any of the rivers, especially on the east side, like the Deschutes, John Day, Klickitat, you'll notice all these big, deep canyons and size meander loops. This is a result of that recent uplift. Here's a little cartoon, and there's a link at the bottom of this page. Dr. Anita Grunder at OSU has put together about a 5-minute animation that kind of explains a lot of the geologic evolution of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And it's an excellent, if some of you may have already seen it, but if you haven't, it's worthwhile looking at because it kind of presents and integrates all these ideas. Because one of the things we got to realize is that our geologic evolution is just not a nice linear progression, one thing happening at a time. We've got a lot of events and processes that are interacting to create the complexity that we're seeing. And this little highly, highly generalized cross-section basically goes from where we're at here in the Puget Sound, kind of to the southeast, or over to the Oregon-Washington-Idaho border. And basically what it's showing is our deep structures here. Off on the right-hand side, we've got the edge of the old North American Craton, and you see all these nice colorful slices, with the last one being Seletsia. These are accreted terrains. And Seletsia is that big chunk of oceanic crust that got accreted about 38 million years ago. And then on top of that, we have all these wonderful, nice intrusives that are basically the result of subduction. These are the roots of the volcanic arcs that are penetrating up through that terrain. And then on top of it, we've got younger basalts and silicic rocks that are related to the Cascades. So anyway, it's lots of hard rock mixed with a lot of soft rock. And just to give you an idea, just focus in on Oregon and Washington here. This is a map showing the extent of middle Miocene to recent volcanic rocks in Oregon and Washington. The brighter the color, the younger they are. So you can see the nice browns and dark blues going north-south. That's the Cascade Arc. The very light blue that you see in a lot of areas, the blue is basalt, and the other colors are more silicic rocks, andesites, dacites, rhyolites. So basically, we've got the Columbia River basalts that cover a vast area. So bottom line with this is we've got a lot of basalt in the northwest here. And that's where things get complicated. Probably if you remember back to your geology classes when you talked about basalts, it was, oh, let's talk about Hawaii. This is basalt. Okay, yeah, it's a basalt, good oceanic island basalt. And typically things are described, this is what you see. You have two end members, types of basalt flows, Pahoehoe and A'a. The A'a has a nice clinkery bottom. The nice silvery looking stuff, that's the Pahoehoe. These are pictures from the Pu'o eruption on the Big Island of Hawaii that began in the mid-1980s and ended in the early 2000s. Generated, about a half a cubic mile of lavas, which sounds like a lot, but really not. In Hawaii, the little block diagram over there shows kind of a conceptual model of how the flows are interweaved. These flows are usually what we call shoestring lava flows. They're very long and not very wide. And with the A'a flows, you have a lot of rubble. You can see the lower left-hand corner there, the molten lava coming in, and you create these levees. So you have dense basalt inside rubble, or in the case of the Pahoehoe flows, you have lobes of lava stacking on top of one another. Over on the right-hand side, just to give you an idea, this is from a quarry on Oahu over in the Halawa, South Halawa Valley, where they exposed a series of Pahoehoe flows. We have the nice little lobates. We actually even have little open lava tubes in there. Down below is, in the same quarry, we have A'a flows exposed. But these are about 2-million-year-old Kualau basalt. And in the 2 million years since they were erupted, the rubbly tops have been highly altered. There's a lot of clay. Remember, with basalt, when you cool it at the surface, it's very glassy. And the glass doesn't behave well, so it will weather. Same with the tops and bottoms of the Pahoehoe lobes. Now, this little block diagram is very important over on the side here, because those black arrows you see, when it comes to estimating transitivity and hydraulic conductivity in the basalts, those arrows generally represent the degree. And these basalts are typically very, very permeable, lots of porosity, both horizontal and vertical. As a matter of fact, you can have open lava tubes in these, so open flows. Well, in the Northwest, we do have Hawaiian-style basalt flows. We have some very young ones. Here's examples from various places, Central Oregon, Southeastern Oregon, Snake River Plain. But the area is largely covered by the Columbia River Flood Basalt Province. It was originally called the Columbia River Basalt Group, which is actually a area up north here. Basically, this part is the Columbia River Basalt Group, but we've recently realized in the last 20 years that old Dr. Aaron Waters was right, that actually the Steens and the Waihee basalts are actually part of that Flood Basalt Province. So that shows the entire extent. One thing about this is we call them flood basalts for a reason. When we got looking at them real hard, I started working on these with Dr. Don Swanson back in the late 70s, and he'd started to work on them in the 60s under Aaron Waters, began to realize that you're talking about flows that really don't look like Hawaiian basalt. Why? Well, first of all, we've discovered that you can actually fingerprint individual flows and correlate and map them over, in some cases, from Western Idaho to Pacific Ocean, one lava flow. They literally have flow volumes typically in excess of 1,000 cubic kilometers. That's like 250 cubic miles of lava. Compare that to the Poo-Oh eruption that spanned better part of 25 years. It produced, if you want to be generous, a half a cubic mile of lava. So you're producing tremendous volumes. And by the way, within the Columbia Basalt Group, there's 300 to 400 of these flows. So, and also, given their size, they're fairly fluid. They cover vast areas. Individual flows have been literally mapped, traced from where they erupted along the Oregon, Washington, Idaho border all the way to the Pacific Ocean and actually up to 30 miles out onto the continental shelf. So these are the world's largest known lava flows. Give you an idea, said we could break them up and map them. Well, this is a Columbia Basalt Group. The upper right side here, that shows you the volume versus time. And you can see that this lower diagram here that breaks out all the members, logarithmic scale, kind of makes it look like, oh, gee, we got a lot of really big lava flows. But the GRB stands for Grand Ronde Basalt. It's one of the most voluminous formations in the Columbia Basalt. And you can see that that represents the majority of the volume of the Columbia Basalt. Matter of fact, most of the Columbia Basalt came out over like a 2-million-year period from around 17 to 15 million years ago. So it came out quite rapidly. As I mentioned, they're big, vast flows. They cover huge areas. They have basically, we're looking at continuous layers. They have the same three-part internal geometry. And why is this important? Well, for a couple of reasons. One is, here is just a diagram showing a three-flow section. And since I deal with groundwater a lot, the Columbia Basalt, one of the things that originally stymied the work on the repository program was because the USGS water resources people had been doing a regional study in the early 70s of the Columbia Basalts to classify that regional aquifer system, and they adopted the Hawaiian model for the hydrogeology of the basalt system. Well, when the repository program began to do packer testing and stuff in the basalt to try to figure out how much water was moving vertically through them, they found out, huh, there's no water moving through the center of these flows. And there's a reason for that. Even though initially, it's just like in Hawaii, the cooling joints, we're talking about fractures here, we have different types of fractures. One is primary, which is cooling joints that form as the lava solidifies. And they can basically, these joints follow a couple of different patterns. Typically, you get the nice columnar, hexagonal, multi-sided columns forming. We refer to that as blocky columnar joining. There's another style, which is actually quite rare in lava flows. It's called entablature colonnade, where you get a basal vertical columns. And the center of the flow, you get all these random joints and fractures. Well, when you actually look, it doesn't matter whether you're in the colonnade or the entablature or blocky columnar, people said, well, you know, in Hawaii, water can move along those cooling joints. It can move vertically, maybe not as fast as through the rubbly parts, but it can move. Well, when BWIP, that was the repository program, began to take a hard look at those cooling joints, they found out that basically they were 98% filled with secondary minerals. They're very narrow to begin with, and what the porosity that was there was largely gone. Any void space wasn't interconnected. So these are basically forming confining layers. This was something that originally stymied the USGS water resources people about the basalts, because people had been drilling groundwater wells into the basalt for years, and in a lot of areas, they had artesian flowing wells at the surface. And they had a problem justifying how you can have artesian wells when their model said, at best, it's a semi-confined system. So wherever you have an artesian well, it's semi-confined, but you find them all over the region. And so what it turns out is that basically all the availability for water in an undisturbed Columbia basalt section is at the tops and bottoms of the flows, where you have the natural brecciated material. So if you go out and you look where the springs are occurring, that's where you're going to find the water. Of course, a lot of things disturb the system. Here's just four examples. The upper left-hand corner, erosion. This is a big one. Matter of fact, it's one of the reasons that contaminants can get down into the basalt. Example, Larsen Air Force Base out in Moses Lake. PCE dumped on the ground, as it was a sack base, and it went through sediments and went into the basalt. And in this case, the basalt had been eroded by the Missoula floods, the Ice Age floods, and had carved down into the basalt, opening up and connecting to the tops and bottoms of the flow. So the TCE went down, got into these flow tops, and it was dipping basalt, and about 3 miles away was a water district that had drilled their water wells, cased and sealed down in the basalt to get away from all the contaminants in the sediment, which includes agricultural stuff, nitrates. And they started getting TCE and nitrates in their drinking water. And what happened was the source was accessed through erosion. You go directly below that, flow pinchouts and erosion. There are places where contaminants can get into the basalt layers. These flows don't go forever, and if they pinch out or are eroded out, like down in the Umatilla Basin, you can get down there. It's both, well, Boeing had a site down there that had TCE, but it was largely agricultural contaminants, gets into the basalt. And people that are down by the Columbia River there on the left-hand side would drill down and go through like two basalt layers and hit the yellow as sediment and hit a sedimentary layer, the base of the basalt, and get groundwater, but find out that it has as high a nitrates as the surface water does. And they couldn't figure out why that was. And also it was a problem for wellhead protection programs because actually anything spilled down by the river there doesn't get through the basalt. It's all coming from up above. And matter of fact, you had to get down into the brown layer to get away from the contaminants. So understanding what's going on, basically the interiors of the flows are forming aquitards and not allowing stuff to get in. We have something else that fractures the basalt. This is what we typically term secondary fracturing. It's faulting tectonic joints. It's a result of regional activity. The picture of some of the fault breccia there, you'll notice there's kind of yellow stuff in between, and it's basically clay, because once again, the basalt is typically fairly glassy, can be fairly glassy, and it'll rapidly alter to clay, because when the fault initially moves and continued movement, it allowed groundwater to move up or down along these fault breccias. But over time, and based on the analysis of some of the clay minerals and how rapidly they form, it could be, you know, literally just a few thousand years, and those fault breccias will actually heal up and become barriers. Water will no longer move along them. And one thing that we have found is, thanks to the Hanford Seismic Monitoring Network in the University of Washington, is that where we see groundwater movement along fault zones, vertically along fault zones, are typically ones that are still seismically active, but low-level seismicity. So you keep re-breaking the rock and allowing the water to move. And matter of fact, some of these zones, these faults extend through the basalt. Oh, by the way, over in the Pasco Basin, thickness of the Columbia basalt, it's around 13,000 feet thick. So we're not talking about a thin layer of stuff, but beneath that is what Shell and Texaco and ARCO and a few people are interested in, is they're looking for natural gas under there, because natural gas, thermogenically cracked and formed, not coming out of the inner beds, out of the sediments or anything, are migrating up from 14, 15,000 feet below ground surface and actually are getting trapped in some of the interflow zones, the tops and bottoms of the CRB flow. The only natural gas field in the state of Washington, operating field, was actually out on the Hanford site, out in front of Rattlesnake Mountain. A sheep rancher back in the late 20s with a cable tool rig looking for water for his livestock drilled a well that started to produce lots of natural gas, which they then drilled several more wells and built a pipeline over to Yakima, Washington. And for about 25 years, they sent gas there. When the Army came in and took over the Hanford site, they just opened the wells up and let it bleed off to the atmosphere. But they probably produced several billion cubic feet of gas. And that stuff came from beneath the basalt. We also have alteration in places the Columbia basalts can be deeply weathered, like south of Portland down towards Salem, Oregon. They actually have been altered to iron-rich bauxites, ferruginous bauxites. And those big rocks you see up by the people standing there, those are actually in-placed centers of the big hexagonal columns. The textures are all there, the remnant textures of the jointing and flow top, flow bottoms are all present, but they've just been altered to bauxite. The other big thing that's one of the biggest problems is, since CRB is a really wonderful aquifer, and my next talk I'll talk a little bit more about this well. This is east of us over town of Warden, north of the Tri-Cities, Hanford site. This well, right there, they're only blowing about 2,000 gallons a minute. They were able at one point to airlift in excess of 6,000 GPM. And they had a hammer bit, and why they were trying to blow that much water was, with four compressor sets, air hammer bit, they could not get the bit to fire on bottom because of the water coming in. And when we put a test, this was a 20-inch diameter well for the city. We put a test pump in there that was capable of doing 5,000 gallons a minute, one of the steps. At 5,000 gallons a minute, it stabilized with, I think it was like 80 feet of drawdown. And they had to terminate that test because the water containment, they had a small creek, river flowing. They're up on top of the Frenchman Hills. Anyway, city's very happy, good quality water. We've got a lot of old basalts. That's Aletzia, the Crescent, Tillamook Volcanics, Waverly Heights, all these older oceanic crust. The problem with these is because they are so old, there's lots of secondary mineralization. These are Hawaiian-style basalt flows. But all of that good interconnected porosity has been destroyed over the last 30-plus million years by secondary mineralization in there and all these white specks. And even the cooling joints, which were originally open, are now little veins of zeolites and silica, things like that. So it's, you know, old basalts don't have much water. Matter of fact, when people drill into this stuff looking for groundwater, they have to hit a secondary fracture, a tectonic fracture, to have even a gallon or two a minute. So this stuff is very tight, and even though it's very widespread in places, it's not great for groundwater, but on the other hand, contaminants don't really get into it. So, and I think at that point, we're done.
Does anyone have any questions for Terry? Okay. If we don't have any questions online right now, then we'll go ahead and...
Well, back again. This time, talk a little bit about drilling. in the hard rock out here, especially the basalts. And typically, one of the biggest problems we have is if it was all hard rock at every site, it would be simple. But it's often not, because you've got overburdened bathozone materials that are soft, and then the hard rocks beneath it. And in the case of the Columbia basalt or drought on the Snake River Plain, there's sedimentary interbeds between. And so depending on how far you have to go, things can get really dicey. And so, you know, just to replow some ground here, before you select the drilling method, you know, for doing subsurface investigations, obviously you've got to think about what's the geology that you're going to be drilling into, the hydrogeologic site conditions. Also, what are you wanting to accomplish? What are you going to want to sample for? Also, well completion and designs. Basically, you got worries about cross-contamination, things like that. Another problem that's typically not too big of a problem unless you're at a place like Hanford is equipment decontamination. You got to be careful. Fortunately, they kind of know where all the real nasty plumes are, but in the bad old days, there are a number of decommissioned buried drill rigs out there that were too radioactive to be decontaminated. And in a lot of cases in urban environments, of course, it's a footprint. You know, what can you get on site? And then finally, everybody's favorite is cost. And in some cases, availability of equipment to drill. Just once again, part of our problem is out here, I mentioned earlier the flood sediments, the Missoula or cataclysmic ice age floods. Upper left-hand corner up there is a map. Every time the continental ice sheets descended out of Canada, they typically ended up blocking off the Clark Fork River, creating Glacial Lake Missoula. And when that ice dam failed, it released humongous quantities of floodwaters, and everybody's probably heard this story. And those waters flowed across the Columbia Plateau and on out to the ocean. But every time they hit a constriction, like, say, at Wallula Gap or west of Portland up at Kelso Longview, situation of hydraulic damming of the floodwaters. And like in the Pasco Basin, the temporary lake was 1,000 feet deep, whereas down in the Willamette Valley, the Portland area, it was only 400 feet deep, but the lake extended south almost to Eugene, Oregon. So, and these floods occurred repeatedly from over 2 million years ago to the last one was around 12 to 13,000 years ago. The next photo down, this is, let's see if I can, hello, there we are. In the distance above the rock up here, this is Sentinel Gap, and the place where that photo was taken is right here. This is part of a gravel deposit from the flood, and a nice big gneissic boulder there. It was probably brought down in the ice and just got stranded there and melted. So all these other boulders that are surrounding it that are a darker color, these are all basalt boulders that have been plucked out of the gap there. And it's not uncommon to have basalt boulders and flood deposits that are the size of a Volkswagen van, small SUV. And so if you've got contamination that's gotten into the basalt underneath this and you have to drill through that, how do you get through it? This is why out in this part of the world, geologic map here, by the way, Columbia River here, this is the Hanford site. Most of the bad areas are down in here and also along the river, the old reactors. So you've got a lot of soft, unconsolidated flood sediments sitting on top of older, consolidated Columbia River sediments, sands and gravels, which is then in turn sitting on top of the basalt. And so you, if you want to drill wells down through this stuff for monitoring, it becomes quite an issue. There's a lot of different ways you can go about it, as I'm sure everybody knows. I'm just going to, on the left-hand side there, talk about now these methods. Percussion, that is cable tool drilling, though in some areas with a rotary rig, you can get down through the overburden if it silts and stuff with an auger and not have to switch out rigs. We'll briefly touch on rotary drilling. Mud rotary, I included that there to basically say that typically it's not a consideration, obviously, especially out here in the Northwest. Most of the drillers use mud rotary for hole stability and hole stability only, and they will actually switch over to air rotary or reverse circulation when they're looking for groundwater. They just to get through the sediments and hold the hole open until they can get some casing in. So they have no idea about what mud engineers do. They can't even comprehend what they do, which people like Jack Souther, who's Halliburton rep out of Yakima, they'll bring them to tears every time. But anyway, we'll go through, touch on some of these methods. And one of the things, too, is nowadays it's gotten very important the type of bit that you end up using with rotary. Let's see here. There we go. We'll start off with cable tool. It's been around for forever. And believe it or not, a lot of people still go with cable tool, especially to get through the flood sediments, the boulders and stuff. This is a very easy method. They drive casing as they go. It's slow. You can track when you hit the water table. You can get samples. It does really good until it gets to really hard rock, like the basalt or anything else that's hard. And it slows down dramatically. You can still keep drilling with this. Matter of fact, the first oil exploration well drilled in the Walla Walla Basin, I think it was like 1918 they started. It was with a cable tool. And they drilled from 1918 to, I think it was 1942. And they got 2,000 feet into the basalt there before they gave up. And the house that they drilled across the road from, I talked with, this was back in the early 80s, we're out doing some mapping, and Grandma was out on the front porch in her rocking chair watching us look at some road crops, and she came wandering over to tell us that when I was born, they were drilling a well right where you guys were looking. And when I came back from normal school, she was a school teacher, they were still drilling when I came back from school. And she said, and I had three kids before they quit. And so, yeah, her whole life was this cable tool rig working on that. So one of the things, though, is that they're, one of the also benefits is they're cheap. So the crew just sits out there. More typically, what everybody's using is some form of air rotary drilling. We have the conventional or direct air rotary, where basically the air is circulated down the center of the drill stem and then comes back up around the hole. Reverse circulation, typically, it's a different system. In this case, the air comes down a special drill pipe. You can tell the two, conventional rotary drilling pipe, just be a steel pipe with one hole in it. If the drilling contractor brings out a pipe that has a channel or a series of tubes around that center thing, bigger diameter pipe, that's reverse circulation pipe. The air will come down, come back out at the bit, and the cuttings will go up the center tube. So there's advantages to both of these methods. The conventional, it's quicker, it's less expensive, but you have hole stability problems. In cases where if you've got soft material or in like the Columbia basalt, often the water-bearing zones are kind of rubbly zones that can collapse in on you. So you've got that. You've also got in those same type of zones with that method, loss of circulation. The cuttings never make it back to the surface, and which is a big problem, and which leads to sampling issues, so big problem. Reverse, typically, also when you're doing the conventional, bringing up, the air is coming down the center of the pipe, coming out at the bit, it lifts the cuttings up, but they have to come up that open hole to the surface typically, and it'll cause erosion, and it can facilitate collapsing, and you know when the driller is cussing and swearing and ready to kill somebody that, uh-oh, he's stuck in the hole, and this can be very expensive. Both methods you can, there are methods to advance casing with drilling, which eliminates those problems, but one of the things, as I'm sure everybody knows, is you have to be very selective with your drilling contractor to make sure they've got the talent and the equipment to do the job, and also be familiar with your site conditions. How tricky are these going to be, and make sure that the driller understands exactly what's going on and what's the potential problems and issues. So if you're just even installing simple monitoring wells, if you're having to drill down through several basalt interbeds, maybe putting in nested piezometers or something, and some of these interbeds can be beautiful ancestral Columbia River, 16 million year old arkosic quartzose sands that are not cemented, and they'll hit these things and they'll flow into the hole. You'll have flowing sands and or squeezing clays, and not good. So with moving on with the rotary, basically what we're looking at is in the method you have air or formational water, but oftentimes drillers will add additives to it. They're basically foaming agents, polymers, to help lift and clean the hole to get the cuttings up and out. And so here's a spectrum that you can go through. On the other end, aerated mud and liquid, which is typically considered mud, you can forget about those because anybody out here who gets a local driller to drill mud and you're trying to monitor zones, what they'll have is a beautiful, stable hole all the way to TD, and they'll guarantee you no water is ever going to come into that hole. So, but you can go all the way from just straight air over to foam. And give you an idea, air rotary drilling. This was with the conventional direct air rotary. This is that City of Warden well that I showed you earlier. Why I put the photo on the right here, on the table here, you see these chunks of rock here. When they were drilling through the center of the flows, we were getting, this is a 20-inch diameter hole, and this was one of the better regional drillers out there, and he had four air compressor sets ganged together to drill this well, because we told him, hey, Dwayne, you're going to hit a lot of water down deep, and it's going to flood your bit. You need to get down there. We told him you need to go about 600 feet. Well, he hit the water at about 500 feet and basically flooded out, but what he hit into was one of these rubbly zones of the Columbia basalt, and those big chunks of rocks are actually drill cuttings that were coming up the 20-inch hole, and they were coming out the discharge pipe there, and some of these would travel literally 50 yards. And thank God it was nothing but sagebrush. And one of them came out and just sheared off a chunk of sagebrush. And so the engineer went out and picked those up because he wanted to take them back for his trophy case. He said he'd never seen drill cuttings. So, you know, part of it is he was able, this was successfully completed well, but if he had just been using the compressor set on the rig there, he would have never been able to basically fully penetrate the aquifer. Wireline rotary coring is probably another method most people in listening to this is, are familiar with. It's a very common method for site characterization, especially for environmental work. It's typically a good method. You get continuous core. Here's a nice basalt core from Goldendale aluminum plant just on the Washington side of the John Day Dam, Columbia River. They were decommissioning all these sites, these aluminum smelters in the Dalles and at John Day. They called it Goldendale. And so, needless to say, there was a lot of contamination, and there they were right on scoured Columbia basalt. And in this case, they decided for characterization purposes to identify where the tops and bottoms of the flows were that they were going to have to core. Very expensive, and they had a lot of core holes. And actually, in the Columbia basalt, with good chip cuttings, you can actually identify where the top of your flow is, the dense interior, and the flow bottoms, and characterize them. And if you go with a little larger diameter hole, you can do a downhole video, which gives you a look at what you've gone through. And so you can, unless you want to do in situ testing on core, it's a lot cheaper not to drill core in basalt sites than it is to do this. And the other problem with core testing, in this case, they wanted to test these cooling joints and fractures, because once the core came up, they got, oh my God, look how big these joints are, these open fractures. And later when they went in and packed them off, nothing. Because what happens is when you core, and it's the same thing you see at the Earth's surface, you remove the lithostatic load, a lot of these joints open, and the process of drilling, they get disturbed, they come up, they look really big. They're nice and wide open, but underground, they're absolutely tight. And so afterwards, they ended up with lots and lots of core and very unhappy. One problem with wireline coring, if you're in a contaminated site or you don't want to contaminate something, with the drilling fluids is oftentimes you can have problems with keeping the diamond core bit lubricated. And it's not only lubrication, but cooling it down. The picture of the bit there in the middle, there is what the bit would normally look like, the one that's laying down. That little jagged end, a piece of pipe, is a $1,000 diamond core bit that basically they didn't want to add any water. This is for a monitoring well. They didn't even distilled water, nothing, can't put it in. And so the driller said, okay, I'm not paying for the bits. He went through four of those in one monitoring well until the client decided, I'll check with Ecology and everybody else and see if we can't. And they said, it's fine. Yeah, go ahead. One of the systems that, at least out in this part of the world, that works really well, and there are several environmental drilling companies that actually deploy this technology, is the downhole hammer combination. You know, it's rotary with an air hammer bit. And in this case, this is a Tubex, is one of the brand names. And basically what it does is it has an overreamer. You can see in the golden picture there, you can see the end of the bit. And then there's another one that sticks out, and basically this is the eccentric reamer bit. And all they do is they put it down the hole, and it basically, you get to the bottom of the casing. This will take casing with you. As you advance, you take casing down. They counter-rotate it. The reamer bit swings out and locks, and then you go on. And what it does is it reams the hole to allow the casing to advance, while the other bit is basically center punching it, and you get good clean samples. One of the disadvantages of this is it's much more expensive, plus it's a hammer bit, so if you hit really big water, you can flood it out. And The other problem is if you go too deep, and especially if you're going through soft stuff that want to squeeze in on the casing, one project had where they're using this system, they had 250 feet of their casing in the ground, which they'll usually, it's nice when you go to build out the well, they pull this casing back up, and it's usually in 5 or 10 foot lengths, usually if you're going deep. And so they can construct the well as you pull up. And so it's very good and precise that way. The only problem is you go through hard rock and the casing, everything, the hole's pretty good. But if you go through inner beds or anything with squeezy clays or stuff, it'll squeeze in on the casing. And usually they don't have a rig's trying to pull the casing back up and won't pull. They do have what they call casing jacks that they can mechanically try to force it out of the ground. And most times that works, but one job, this company that you actually see in the picture here, they ended up leaving, it was like 80 plus feet of this threaded casing in the bottom of the hole because the joint failed when they were trying to jack it up and out. And the owner of the company said, well, he says, I won't be making any money on my next 5 jobs just to pay for what happened there. The last method to talk about here is something that's quote unquote new. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with it. It's sonic or rotosonic drilling. Sonic drilling is a very relatively new. Back in the mid 90s, I wasn't working at Hanford at the time, but one of the drilling companies that was developing this technology wanted to prove the Department of Energy that they could drill through the flood basalts and the flood sediments. Everything that's at Hanford, they could drill through. And initially, you know, they had good success getting through the flood sediments. And one of the nice things about sonic is that you get continuous sampling, and they can bring it up. It usually goes into plastic sleeves, which can then be transferred into, you know, core boxes and things. And in hard rock, you'll actually get nice intact core. If it's fractured really badly, broken with faults or something, it'll come up as gravel or rubble. But one of the problems they initially had, and in unconsolidated sediments, was they drilled like 30 feet and were going to bring up their 20 foot of core, and they ended up, oh, well, we should only have 10 feet of new stuff in here, but the entire 20-foot tube is full of cuttings, sand. And it was part of the problem. They didn't at the time, they had only, I think it was only a single frequency that they could vibrate, because this is a combination, if you're not familiar with it, is the rotary drilling. So you're turning the bit, plus you have a device that basically is causing the drill string, the bit, to vibrate at frequencies with between 50 and 160 hertz, which allows, you know, not only are you getting the percussion, the breaking of the rock, but the vibration, so things don't want to stick. And it's actually quite a clever method. It's definitely more expensive, but it's something that's worthwhile. We'd probably use it more at Hanford if it wasn't so expensive, because if they accidentally contaminated a rig like that, and that's typically what they look like, truck-mounted rigs, then somebody would be buying the rig. But let's see here. At this point, went through that quick, but if there's any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. If not,
does anyone? Oh, we've got a question in the room.
So you talked a lot about casing, and I got the impression that in these basalt systems that these wells need to be cased generally because the rubble zones don't stay open, or do you sometimes have open holes?
A lot of times you can get away with just open holes. Most water wells, the rules now for well construction requires them to case and seal. Used to be, you know, at least 4 or 5 feet into dense competent rock, so basically just the surface seal. But now both Oregon Water Resources Ecology, and I'm not sure about Idaho, if they've gotten to this point, but now for like water wells, they'll tell you to take water from a specific part of the basalt, a specific unit, and you've got to run your production casing from the surface down to the top of that and cement grout that in. Oftentimes here for environmental, what they're trying to do is just, you know, literally control the hole. And if you're in certain areas where you have a lot of sedimentary interbeds between, go with the Tubex, you know, some sort of dual wall system, that, because otherwise, if you're just conventionally drilling it, these zones will start completely unraveling and coming into the hole. And you've got to stop it somehow. And if you want to monitor it, typically the well drillers, the water well guys, oh, you want me to control that? That's fine. We'll get the cement truck out here and a trimming tube. I'll go spot a pill of cement down there. We'll wait 24 hours, and we'll go drill it out. So that it's all sealed off now. I can continue drilling open hole. And so they'll fight through these zones, and that's great for drilling a water well when you know you're going deep. But for environmental monitoring wells, unless you purposely want to, you know, seal it off, it's kind of a, you know, it's not a proper method. And that just gets back to, there's a lot of great drillers out there that can drill water wells, but for environmental geotechnical holes, you really need to vet your drilling contractor and make sure that they've done the work before, because sure, these other guys are less expensive, but they may not have the right equipment. And so for, you know, environmental type stuff, typically try to specify a list of qualified drilling contractors. Given contracting rules and stuff like that, you sometimes can't do that, but it's otherwise, whoever gets the job, you may end up having all sorts of nightmares and eventually having to kick them off the site for non-performance. But it's, yeah. So, yeah, it's, you basically got to match, you can do a prognosis. There's so many water wells and stuff, and, you know, with the Columbia basalts are really well behaved that way. People have drilled them. So you can basically take a look at surrounding water wells or whatever and kind of know what's going on. So it's kind of like the geophysics, kind of figure out conceptually what's there before you start and plan that way, and always plan for the worst. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, if there are no more questions in the room or online, we'll go ahead and go back to Fred DeLewis.
Checking 1, 2, 3. Highway Vance. Hi, my name is Tim Maley. I'm a hydrogeologist here in Region 10 Seattle in the Science Division. I volunteered to give this talk. I had some limited experience with these multi-level systems, and Claire touched on that just previously in her talk, and I'll tell you about the commercially available multi-level monitoring systems that are available. So what is it? On the left, you can see kind of the old school, where you have your nested wells that are installed in individual boreholes at various depths of the aquifer. The one in the middle, I've never really come across. I'd be curious if anyone has known, is whether you anyone drilled a very large diameter hole and put in wells and then stacked bentonite on top in between the well screens. I don't think it exists, but apparently this drawing indicates that they did exist at one time. And then the one on the right shows kind of what these MLS systems exist, and that's one borehole with depth-specific multi-port samplers that are strategically designed. And I'll go over how that's designed a little bit later. So here's a site I worked on, old school. Anyone ever come across a site like this? You have numerous well nests either in a line or in a, you know, all within maybe a 10 or 20 foot radius around the monitoring point at various depths. Here is galvanized or capped. You don't know what depths they are. Who knows how old, whether the screens are any usable or not, but so I would throw that in there. So old school, new school. This is a multi-level system. Obviously one borehole with all the tubings and everything coming out of there that's related to the ports that are at a depth specific, at a specific depth in order to collect samples. So what are commercially available MLS systems? Three of them I'm going to talk about: Waterloo by Solenis, West Bay by Schlumberger, and the Water Flute, which Claire also talked about. It stands for Flexible Liner Underground Technology. They are all widely used, obviously, because they all got nice web pages with the pictures and they're selling their product. And I'm familiar with the food systems. They're used quite extensively on the East Coast. I'm not familiar with any of them used here in Region 10, but we do have fractured rock, and those fractures can quite go down deep, and including the contamination going that deep. So I think that's a viable tool out here in Region 10 also. Why use them? Well, you got to know what the, you know, your site, you know, your conceptual site model, you know, you got an idea of what the depth of groundwater is, your aquifer thickness, you know, do you have a vertical expanse of a fractured system where contamination can go that would really lend to the use of these systems. Some of the selection considerations: how long are you going to use it? You know, I don't know what the lifespan of these are, but I'm guessing maybe not as long as those old galvanized wells that are in the ground, but I'm guessing that with the flute and some of the other downhole tooling and equipment associated with these do have a certain lifespan and require some O&M, which is part of the other considerations. There is a lot of downhole equipment that can go in there. What are your actual monitoring needs? You know, water levels, hydraulic connectivities, obviously contaminant concentrations and so forth. What type of drilling methods are you anticipating? How large your work area? Are you in an operational RCRA facility with very limited space, or are you in a landfill with all kinds of space to work in and around? And then, again, about the lifespan of them, are they eventually going to have to be decommissioned? The advantages, reduced footprint, basically one borehole with numerous sample ports down to depth. Now, they say reduced drilling costs. I don't know really if that's true, because I think a lot of times that I know numerous monitoring wells would cost more than one well, but I think all said and done with the technologies and the equipment and the specialized people you might have to have on site in order to install these systems, maybe it's a wash. I don't know. I'd be curious to see your experiences with that would be. It says reduce sampling costs. You know, I suppose less decon. You know, again, with the multi-well systems, the tubing coming at a surface, baywars are not going down the hole or pumps that need to be deconned in between. So I bet maybe in the long run, your sampling duration or the amount of effort to sample the particular multi-level system could be less. Disadvantages, like I said, there's a lot of specialized equipment associated with this. A lot of them need a gas-driven pumps or bladder pumps. The West Bay requires a wireline tool to get in and out of the that particular well. There are some limited use and observation wells during some aquifer testing. However, I think you can utilize the system, say, if you're pumping one well at a certain depth within a fractured system. Why not use the monitoring well, the multi-level well, to determine what might be influenced due to that pumping? Again, I talked about lifespan. With all that downhole equipment going in there, subsequent to some failures. And then there is some O&M. The assumption, which goes for these systems or any monitoring well, is that the ambient groundwater flow must maintain representing groundwater at the sampling port. That's kind of just almost a disclaimer. So the Waterloo system, one borehole, basically straddled screens in between packers. And that's pretty much it. Obviously, the Waterloo company manufactures all the equipment. So it could be designed specific to the site, and I'll talk about some of those design considerations a little later on in this presentation. So their advantage is, they say, was a gas-driven sampling, either a double valve or a bladder pump. It is able to contain large sample volumes, used, you know, such as for treatability studies. It does have low flow capabilities, which is kind of a requirement, obviously, when you're sampling for VOCs. And it's a proven technology that's been around for a while. I don't know about any of these systems that are in the ground. I'd be curious to see if anyone has any experience about this particular company's systems and whether you had luck or any experiences of your own. Their disadvantages, as you'll see in the pictures, it's a relatively complicated installation process. It's like putting together a huge line of wells, you know, laid alongside the drilling and then laying them up and bringing them in. And the way down area I brought up, the packers, transducers, pumps are all down holes. And they say there's some tubing issues, and you'll see during the installation pictures how things can be kinked. So here's some examples that were provided in the previous slide. This presentation was presented on the East Coast, and I utilized a lot of these pictures. So here's the Waterloo system. You see how it's laid out. Here's obviously a nice winter day somewhere, probably in the East Coast. And all, you know, plastic lying on the ground. And say if you have a 100 or 200 foot well to put in the ground, can you imagine the logistics in trying to get this thing in? And there's the kinking problem, I think. You know, if that, if you turn that thing, you know, if it's on end, you know, I'm guessing I'd be very cautious and want to inspect that tubing before it went down the hole. You hate to have to put that all in and find out that you kinked or cut a tube and then the system's not working, and you pull everything out. You can imagine what kind of nightmare that would be. Some of the components, you do have your little sampling port, which is maybe a little screen section. There's a transducer on top. Then there's a bladder pump, I believe, it goes down also with the equipment. Sampling, just like any other sampling, I have the multi-port system up on top. Can you get an idea of some of the wiring and then the tubing that's relative to the sample port depth? And it's utilized gas, especially nitrogen and inert gas, which is typical for using in these gas, compressed gas sampling scenarios. So that was the West, that was Waterloo, and then West Bay. West Bay is remarkably similar. They're, let's go through these. Screens separated by packers. These packers are filled with water for some reason to a certain PSI. I believe the other packer systems are probably air again to a certain PSI. And Claire touched on the fact that you got ragged boreholes. Then hopefully you got packers that are robust enough that they're not going to be punctured and so forth. And I believe there's probably a PSI rating, making sure you don't underinflate them. You're going to weak them. You overinflate them. You're going to bust them and everything back out the hole. It shows here a sampling port and then a measurement port. So I measure the sampling port is probably a screen area where your pump's going to go down and collect your sample from. Measuring port, sampling from the measuring port, and the pumping port is for some hydraulic connectivity and purging. Advantages and disadvantages of the West Bay system. Again, it's similar to the Waterloo. It's a relatively simple installation, requires a small work area. Transducers and samplers are on a wire line. They do pressure test the joints following the installation. There is some long-term maintenance. The long-term maintenance requirements are quite low. It's also a proven technology. Some of the disadvantages, different from the Waterloo system, apparently a maximum volume per trip is only 1 liter. There's no pre-purge or low-flow sample collection method. So for dealing with VOCs, I mentioned this would kind of write off this particular system. It has some limited capabilities on water quality data, especially DO. I'm not quite sure why. So here's some examples of their equipment, everything all laid out on those horses. And again, I talked about the design, you know, the depths and so forth are all designed based on downhole geophysics and packer tests, and I will touch on that a little bit. Just have a close-up of some of their components. There's the kind of little screen section and then the measuring port. Here's it going into the ground. The blue segment is the packer. I'm assuming it is, but I'm pretty sure I'm right on that. Then they're off to the side there where it's assembled. They're doing some pressure testing. I suppose you lose the pressure, you got some leaks, so you have a problem. Sampling equipment, bladder pump being wire lined down to the depth specific zone and sample away. I believe it's also, I said it was used compressed gas too. I don't see a cylinder out there, but that's what the earlier slides say. So flute, this is what I'm somewhat familiar with, at least from working on a site on the East Coast, but I got some pictures on that, and it's certainly applicable to any fractured rock environment. The two kind of that are showing up on this slide here is the blank liner that Claire also talked about. Basically, you have an open borehole. It's going to be open for a certain amount of time. Get that liner in. A rule of thumb on the site I worked on was that you're gone for the weekend, put the liner in. Overnight, no. And I'm curious if that seemed to be adequate from some of your experiences. What was interesting about putting the liner in the hole is that Claire, you touched on, you know, obviously it's got to be transmissive down to the bottom of the hole. You got competent rock, that liner's not going in. You're going to come to the bottom fracture and it ain't going to budge. Now, I had a project manager that promised the fact that we're going to get that liner to the bottom of the hole, and we waited, it sank, we sank. We kept the head of water on inside of the liner as high as we can get. You can't put a bypass in, you know, a tubing maybe slink down the outside to allow that water to come out so you can get the liner on down. Guess what happened when we came back, yanking it out of the ground. So we ripped it. We had to get out of the ground and continue with the borehole and continue on our way, so we just trashed it and ordered another liner. So there's, you know, that can happen. If you have competent rock and you had that liner ain't going, I think you don't need to get it on down. You're probably okay to leave it at that specific depth. But and then on the right, it kind of shows all the components associated with their multi level monitoring system, and the it's simply a blank liner with all the components. We pick the depths where the spacers for the port, which is going to be up against the wall, which was basically similar to a screened area that's going to allow to collect a sample from that particular interval. So the advantages, again, the liner seals the entire borehole, whether it's a multi-well system or a blank liner. Is a relatively simple insulation process. If everything goes well and you don't have a competent rock, you're trying to get the liner on down the hole. The gas, the sampling does require compressed gas. You can pump all day. You know, you can grab your large volumes. You can tune it down to get low flow capabilities, to get all the water quality parameters you can. This is a proven technology. Again, I know it's being used quite extensively on the East Coast. Disadvantages, a lot of downhole equipment that could go bad. The liner can rip whether you're pulling on it or not. Gas lines must be purged to obtain current water level readings. You can't collect the potentiometric heads out of the tubes, you know, with probably a little, your thin little water level meter down in each little tube. But you purge them first. Probably everything rises up to the potentiometric head or whatever water level goes in and around the liner, that's where your levels. So you purge them, then you can collect your water levels. This last one here, water level inside the liner must be checked and maintained above static head formation. As you can see in this on the left, you see how that water level inside the liner is above the static water level of the formation. Well, evaporate, whatever, over time, that would drop, but Foote says make sure that water level inside the liner stays above your static water level. So you pretty much come out and you check it every now and then. Flute sells their Quintet system. I touched on the first one, blank liner, and actually I touched on the last one, their water flute, but they also sell what they call a Napple flute. Basically, it's a liner with some colored stripes of some material on the outside of the liner after it's, you know, inverted into the borehole. You leave it in there for a while, you pull it out, where'd the color change? Or actually, if there's product, it would show up on the side of the liner, and we've had that happen at the site in New Jersey. And by that, you say, well, how deep is it then? Where did that come in? So you do get an idea where you might have El Napo in your borehole. They also sell this felt-activated carbon technique, FACT, But apparently it's the same kind of principle where there's something on the outside of the liner that's going to react with any dissolved contaminants, put it in, leave it there, pull it out. Where did the color change? We might have some dissolved contamination. I think it's qualitative, not quantitative. But I haven't used either of those. But, again, Carl, what's his, Keller, I believe, the guy who's selling all this stuff, he's the greatest thing. And then, Claire, you also touched on the transmissivity profile, which is your blank liner that's just lowered at a rate and monitored its descent. So here's some examples. There's your blank liner. If I had a the material is like a raincoat. It's like a fabric enforced raincoat material, just like your North Face waterproof material. That's what it reminded me of as far as playing with the stuff. You order it specifically. You get it on these spools right to your site. And don't forget, you're going to have to purchase this reel. You ain't going to get in the ground unless you buy Carl's special installation reel. And then hang on to it. You'll probably need that for in and out removals and so forth, or contact the next guy who's going to buy one and says, I got a reel for you. I don't know how much they are, but it's these kind of tools surprise you when you get out in the field. You go, okay, I got the liner. How do I get in there? Oh, you didn't order the reel. So you call Carl and say, send me this thing, will you? So I just get an idea. I talked about going in, going out. And then kind of what it all looks like, your sampling procedure. It's pretty much an airlift system. You know, you pressurized gas goes in and the air will go out, but then it'll pull the water from the port and then out through your sample container and so forth, purge and sample. What they do is they test these kind of up front, you know, during following installation. How well is the water coming out? What kind of gas pressure can I put into the system? What's going to be the optimum amount that I use? It's all written on down. You put them on your sampling forms quarterly or whatever. You come back the next quarter and you go, okay, this particular port, I'm going to use this much pressure. I'm going to purge this much. And it's a consistency method. I think it kind of works well that's site specific. So here's some examples. Again, there's that special reel we had to buy. That's a liner going in. This is a site from the previous slides. I believe that's probably a multi-level well going in the ground. Looks quite elaborate. Actually, gets more complicated. There's, I think, my site in New Jersey. You can see adding water. You see the water going in there. Again, keep the water charged through the installation process. There's, I believe this is Garfield site out somewhere in New Jersey also. Diane Cutt, I don't know if she's on the line, but she provided me with this picture. It's from a site that she used these quite a bit on in her sandstone contaminant. Sandstone aquifer contaminated hexadale and chromium, I believe. And there's your finished product. Looks pretty, doesn't it? And well advertised also. So design considerations. Again, know your exceptional site model. A good knowledge of your site geology, the vertical hydrostratigraphic data, any groundwater quality data that you do obtain, but you don't have any of that. You have very limited amount of that. Downhole geophysics. That's what we start with. Open borehole, you run the whole gamut of downhole. The key really is, you know, the caliper and the imaging and the ambient flow. Where are these fractures? Are they producers? That's all mapped on your geophysical borehole. You bring it back to your office, try to identify where these fractures are. And by selecting where those zones are, you go back and say, okay, I'm going to pack test those. So you pack or test those particular intervals. I also said, in the downhole geophysics, also the ambient flow and the pumping flow are quite important. Where's water coming in? Where's it going out? And that also helps you take all that data, develop your pack or test designs, go in and you pack off these. Are they producers? Once you pack them off, these zones, are they producers? And you can kind of determine, are we pumping hard? Are we pumping easy? I'm getting a lot. It's competent rock isn't that the zone that we thought it would be. And then we also collected into the groundwater samples. After a certain amount of purging, collected for VOC, sent out to the lab, to what kind of concentrations that we have. And Claire also touched on that too. How many ports you think you're going to need? How deep you think you're going to go? You know, these are obviously design considerations. Obviously, this can be used in overburden and bedrock. I wouldn't recommend direct push. I don't know why that's up there, but I think your sonic, your hollow stems are going to work on your unconsolidated. And we use their rotary, you know, to get in the crystalline rock for the food installations that I worked on. So here's an example of a downhole, four-hole geophysical log. Again, it was important for us to know where the fractures were, and by looking at the opticals imaging, it's pretty apparent where kind of they are just from the visual, where the water might be coming in and going out, and then and sometimes a caliper. The caliper is going to tell you if you have some sort of major fracture. This is a log from the site I worked on, so I'm somewhat more familiar with this one. But on the left, you can see the blue is the ambient flow, and the red is the, I believe, heat pulse. We did heat pulse? We did heat pulse, and we did pumping. But anyway, it gives you an idea. Water is currently coming in from that top fracture area, and it's going down, down, down. This is only page 1 of 3 on this log. You know, we went to 200, 300 feet. So it did exit at one particular time. And then below that was a lot of zeros. So no flow below that competent rock, even though little micro fractures you can see in the squiggles on the optical. But for the most part, it's just, we got a good idea where we're going to want to put our Packer tests. And Claire, you mentioned about being very flexible on the Packer lengths. Drillers went out will come with, you know, they'll come with 5-footers or 10-footers. At least from between the Packer zones. Now, sometimes 2-footers, whatever. So you're somewhat limited, but you can, you know, obviously you don't want to cover an area, a 10-foot zone with 12 fractures or something like that. If you can limit those and find out which ones are producers and which one not. And I think we are kind of limited to 5 feet between our Packer zones. But ahead of time, you tell your drillers, bring 1-foot sections, you know, whatever you can in order to help us make the interval between our Packers suitable to the near site. So here's some pictures. top one, your geophysical sond ready to go into a hole. And then the right one is your geophysical guy sitting in the cab with this laptop in front of him, you know, slowly descending in and then coming out, developing the log. And then bottom left would be following all these geophysical interpretations and looking at the log and so forth, selecting the Packer intervals, that's us collecting into the groundwater samples from a packed off zone. I believe we purge them for 30 minutes. You know, obviously look at your parameters, your stability, make sure it's stable and so forth. I try to remain consistent and collecting the samples then following all that. So, site characterization using the multi-log data. This is a conceptual site model, basically, of a crystalline site. What we had here is on top of the hill, we had a dump. Down there, bottom of the left, we have residential areas that had TCE in their wells. There's wells about 300 feet. They're open hole in the granite. And how did the contamination from the top of the hill get down there? So it was pretty much fractures in that granite within the first one, all the way down to 300 feet. The EPA originally, Region 2, said, well, we want these holes to be 600 footers, because they took the height between the top of the hill and the residential wells instead of the bottom of the wells, and they said 300 to 600 feet. And so I don't think we got fractures down to 600, but we'll give you a lot. We found out that after we got to about 400, it was competent. We needed to go that deep. That's what an outcrop nearby looked like, kind of what we're dealing with. Fractures in every direction. It's a syenite, what it's called, granite. And it was interesting to see that. It's like, oh, okay, well, the fractures, yeah, it could be anywhere. And there was a seep coming out of there, too, at one of those locations. So following all the geophysical and the Packer tests, kind of look at where we put the sample ports, okay? But those purple lines would be the fractures that were identified in the geophysical bore logs. It would be nice to be able to connect those fractures between the locations. I don't think it's possible unless you had more data. But just give you a general idea of what we ended up doing and then kind of what we got out of it, sampling the individual ports. We did find good correlation between the Packer test results and the multi-level port sampling results also. And so I guess you had a good 2D picture on what your plume might look like. you know, that's not all one mass. Obviously, that's just based on the fractures in the individual ports. So Region 10, Moses Lake, it's a site I'm currently working on. Could we use an MLS well here? Sure. You know, this site has been thoroughly characterized already. This is a conceptual site model, how it looks cross-sections. You got your Hanford Formation up near the sod, sands and gravels. We've 100 feet of it maybe, then you get into the silt above, the basalt flows. You got your verticals, you got your basalt, the permeable material on top of the flows and in between and so forth. And here they know that the contamination, obviously from the surface, got down top of the silts. It might be getting through that silt formation. I don't know if there's not wells out there now to indicate that there's contamination or not. They know it's in the basalts. And there isn't any multi-well systems out here. However, I think the site could be conducive to that. I believe there is 100 wells out there now already, so I don't think it argues. Says we need to get more out there. We're in the remedial action stage. There's a few plumes that have already been mapped, and there's a pump and treat system going in one of those plumes as I speak. But I just want to show you that Region 10, you know, with this cross-section could be a site. And mining sites are obviously possible, too, with some of the fractures that go quite deep with the contamination associated with those. So that's all I got. Any questions? Sure, Renee.
The quality control, you put
the quality control.
Well, like a quality control, you're trying to put that flute system, I can see you lowering it, but then you have the sampling port next to it. How do you figure out, I can see how you logged in, you wanted a location to sample. When you're putting that thing down, how do you know that thing landed on that area?
Just assuring that the unraveling of the flute well is going to, from the surface, not have any kinks. It's going to fall freely into the well and maintain as smooth along the side of the wall.
And is there a way to recheck that once you set it? It seems I'm just not that trusting. I believe in things that are a little bit more solid that I can measure, and I go at 37 feet down, and the hole is 38.
To answer your question, I don't believe there's any method to really check to make sure that that sampling interval is at where it's supposed to be, other than how it's designed. I mean, when you get the food system, it's going to say, this is the ground surface, you know, the red line across the thing. Make sure that thing's at the ground surface so all the, what you told us to put that port in, you know, 80 to 90 or whatever, is you that red line there, and this thing falls into the well in a straight line without any kinks or twists or something like that, that he's assuring you that that interval is going to be at the depth that you want it to be.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I think Gene might have a question for you.
Gene. Gene on the phone.
Hello. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So very, very quickly, we had a comment that came in from one of the participants about the mention of system complexities. And they just wanted to note that there was an option out there that they didn't hear discussed, which was a piece of technology which basically allows you to do low cost compared to other multi-levels or nesting of wells. There's no T profiling, and the transducers apparently are not difficult, and the sampling can be done pretty easily with tubing and a check valve. And they note that you can use the data collected during purging to calculate K based on methods of Robbins. So it was a CMT from a particular company, and they just wanted to note that this type of technology exists. And I don't know if anyone's ever used this type of a technology or has any experience with it.
I have not. And I only talked about those three. I know there's other technologies that are available, and I believe as time marches on, they're only going to get better. Someone's going to develop, invent another better mousetrap. So, yeah, I'm not surprised.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tim.
All right.
Next, we've got Ellen Shapiro back up. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. Okay. Okay, our next speaker is Don Claybaugh. He is an EPA hydrogeologist here in Seattle.
Well, I'm going to brief you on a site in southwest Oregon. It's an abandoned mine site. It's called Formosa Mine, and it's a Superfund site in fractured rock. There we go. This picture shows the main attic to the site and the lowest elevation at it. Can you guys hear all right? And trying to manage the water coming out of there, so contractors set up a couple large containment vessels. Ted, should I bring my computer up or can you change that? Okay. All right. Sites in southwest Oregon. It's south of Eugene, north of Medford. It doesn't mean a lot to folks from the East Coast. It's halfway between Portland and San Francisco, maybe. The reason it's a Superfund site is the metals from the abandoned mine enter a stream. They've compromised the habitat. There's miles of stream that used to support endangered coho salmon. Stream doesn't support anything now except for sulfide mineralization and precipitates as the pH slowly rises from about 2. Ambient water quality criteria is exceeded for zinc, copper, and cadmium. The deposit, the Silver Butte deposit, is a volcanogenic massive sulfide ore deposit. It's about 500 to 600 feet thick, and it's mainly foliated ash tuffs that have primary porosity and permeability that have been filled in, cemented with the sulfide ore materials. And then it's offset by several major faults and lots and lots and lots of fracturing. The economic minerals were calcium pyrite and sphalerite. Also has a lot of pyrite in it, and it was processed mainly for copper and zinc, a little bit of gold, and some silver. So the host rock units are basalt folds, foliated dacite, ash flow tufts, bedded tufts, basaltic tufts, and for the most part, those are all subaqueously deposited volcanic rocks. So the difference in porosity and permeability between the basalt flows, the ash flow tufts, the bedded tufts are great, as we've talked about all day. There's a wide range of permeabilities, and these are made even greater by fracturing and faulting. So a little bit of site history. Site was mined from 1910 to 1937. Then it was reopened in 1990 through 93. After closure, the mine operator backfilled tailings, crushed ore, concentrates. They just kind of shoved everything back into the mine. and then put some wood and burlap on top of it, threw some concrete on top of it, and then stuck a pipe on top of all of that so the water could flow out. They left a mess in the creek. About 20 tons of tailings were hand-dug, shovel-dug, funneled into buckets by hand. It's a very steep reach of stream. So the government's been managing the site since 1996. They've accomplished a lot. They did this cleanup work in the stream. They finished the job of getting the worst of the ore and the tailings back into the mine. They improved the drainage, although at least seasonally and sometimes more often, the corrugated pipe comes loose during high flow events. At the Formosa 1 adit, the flow averages about 12 gallons a minute. It ranges from 2 to 40 gallons a minute. And so after the restoration bond ran out, the mine operator came up with another $500,000, and then the state of Oregon came up with I don't know how much. And then the federal government put it in Superfund so that we could use government funds to manage and clean up the site. EPA works with Bureau of Land Management, which actively manages the site, and with the Corps of Engineers. Most recently, the Corps hired CDM Smith for site work. BLM has used Tetra Tech and Northwind. And we've been working on what we call Operable Unit 1, which is the solid waste, since 2009. In 2016, we did a record of decision. Calls for excavation about 140,000 cubic yards of mine materials, covering 55,000 cubic yards, covering the former tailings pond and reclamation for the excavated areas. Last year, we did, I should back up. In 2014, Bureau of Land Management did what they call an engineering evaluation and cost analysis, which led to a non-time critical removal action. They put a steel bulkhead in Formosa 1 at it and put a nice pipe through it with a gate valve so they can actually manage the flow now. That was completed in 2018. And this year they're working on establishing a new diversion system for the drainage so it doesn't knock itself loose every wet season. During the OU1 rod, there was a conceptual site model developed. Big questions around groundwater. Next year, we're kicking off the groundwater operable unit two. So we've got lots of stuff to figure out. You see the red circles here. What's the relationship of bedrock to surface water? We've got a little waterfall there. That's the further red circle. And at that particular point on Upper Middle Creek, there's not much alluvium. And downstream of that, there's no at least visible orange or yellow seeps. So we're hopeful that most of the seeps and fractures discharge to shallow alluvium upstream of the waterfall. And the reason for that is the waterfall is a barrier to salmon fish passage. So we might actually be able to do some treatment in the stream. We're also going to look at doing some treatment on the discharge from the adit itself. This is a blow-up of that conceptual site model right around the Formosa 1 adit. Like I said, the adit's the lowest portal to the mine. The mine extends 420 feet above the adit, 290 feet below the adit. We do have some alluvial, we'll call it an aquifer. It's really just mine drainage going through mine development rock, tailings, crushed ore, all the junk that was left. Further down into the headwaters, it becomes more of a alluvial aquifer. It's got some organic matter from trees. But as we move down the slope, we see the seeps coming right out of the bedrock. We did a pretty good seep and spring survey during the operable unit 1 RI, and we've got some good information right around the adit just from years of managing the flow out of the mine. So our main challenges will be figuring out where the bedrock fractures serve as conduit for the mine water into the streams, how to remediate or treat the flow of metals to the stream, and how to treat the flow through the adit. And just to give you an idea, the stream's further down the slope, but these are the various adits. Formosa 1 adit is in the upper right corner, and everything in red here is above the adit. Everything in blue is below the adit. Right around Formosa 1 adit, there was a fracture zone that was studied in some detail, a bunch of strike and dip measurements, and some measurement of flows. We got several gallon per minute out of a number of the seeps that were surveyed. Strike and dip was analyzed statistically, and a stereo net was put together. It had three different statistically significant fracture trends. The S2 trend is interesting in that it goes to the northwest, and that's where most of the seeps and springs are. So it gives us a starting point to look at those. These seeps and springs are shown in the box. The Formosa 1 adit is shown in the circle there. And that S2 strikes northwest. It dips 60 to 70 degrees. And so the elevations look like they work out. This is MW2, which is the bedrock well near Formosa 1 adit. And the driller noted, his air rotary open hole, driller noted fracture zones, a couple of them above where he encountered water, and a couple of them below that he notes 1 gallon a minute flow. He's got another one that says produce a lot of water. So this is good information for us. And if we project that S2 fracture orientation from the well MW2, that green line is the surface, the blue is the fracture depths noted on the log. Looks like it explains at least the MB series of seeps and springs. The MA46 is actually in the stream. And took a look at some hydrographs to figure out time lag. This is an interesting one. It's MW2, that same bedrock well, following a couple of precipitation events. It had a time lag of about 12 days between the peak precipitation and the peak water level. This one shows MW24, which is a really curious well. It's not really a well. It's an angular boring that's cased in the open space behind the bulkhead in the attic. So literally, if you go into the attic behind that bulkhead, you see this PVC screen sticking out of the wall. So we'll call it a well, but it's not like MW2. It shows a five-day lag period between the precipitation events and the peak water level elevation behind the bulkhead. So that puts MW2 time lag in context. It might take 5 days for precipitation to go through fractures in the bedrock into the mine, and then another 7 days for it to go through the fractures in the bedrock and express itself in MW2. This is a hydrograph that shows MW24. That's the well screened in air behind the bulkhead, and MW8, which is a well screened in the mine workings, but actually screened in old tailings that were backfilled into the mine. And if you look at the increase in water level, it's apparent that the water level elevations in the mine increase rapidly, up to 25 feet in a few days. But in MW24, where there's free discharge out of the bulkhead, the water levels decline pretty quickly after the precipitation event. And at MW8, which is screened in tailings in the fine, that's the black line, the recovery after the precipitation events takes quite a while. And then apparently the transducer clogs and quits functioning. So in last year, the new bulkhead was installed at Formosa 1 at it. And then this year, in March, we had a lot of snow, 3 to 4 feet of snow. Nobody could get up to the site for about a month and a half. When they did get up to the site, they showed some pictures, nice colors on the road, and a good flow out of one of those pipes the mine operator had put in an adit. This wasn't at Formosa 1 adit. This is at the Silver Butte adit, about 75 feet higher. So after that, it started raining. We had crazy April rainfall. So looking back at the conceptual model, one thing that folks had hypothesized was that most of the acid rock generation occurred when water infiltrated through bedrock into the mine, in that unsaturated mine workings area where had lots of native sulfide ore that had never been saturated, like the stuff in the rest of the mine workings. And now, after the precipitation events and our new bulkheads installed, we get our chance to raise our water level up into those unsaturated ore deposits and see what that does to water quality. So we we sampled the water in April. So the orange highlighted cells, those are chemical parameters that are more than an order of magnitude higher than the previous maximum concentration at that area. So for example, at MW2, the zinc, which previously had averaged 142 micrograms per liter, is now 16,200 micrograms per liter. The MB1 seep sample, new zinc level, 17,200. The manganese is more than an order of magnitude above previous levels. So it looks like our hypothesis that we should keep those previously never saturated ore workings dry is a good operating principle for managing the site. And so the orange bar here shows the elevation of the mine workings. The blue bar shows the elevation of MW2. And all I'm really trying to convey here that is as you work your way down the slope towards the stream, zinc concentrations do fall off fairly quickly. And we got to remember this was an April sampling event during historically large precipitation events. So we're kind of lucky. We got lots of dilution going on. This month, we're going to do another round of samples, and we'll see what the results are. Hopefully, some of the bedrock fractures got some of that concentrated metals and they've dropped out into sulfide minerals and precipitated as salts in the fractures, and we won't continue to see those kind of water quality results that'll go back to the typical historical really bad water quality results. So our next step, as I mentioned, is to try and figure out how to treat the mine water. We've done some bench scale studies on sulfate bioreactors using ground up oyster shells. We're considering using biochar as well. Any kind of a media where we can entice sulfate reducing bacteria to grow. And certainly those three ponds, if we add one as a settling basin, another one to neutralize the pH, and a third one to put a bunch of ground-up oyster shells and culture some bacteria, maybe we can make some improvements on the water quality. So we're going to at least conceptualize the same idea in the upper reaches of the stream itself, upstream of the waterfall where the fish can't go. We've also got to figure out how to manage water in the mine itself. And looking at using PRISM, which is a Oregon State University parameter estimation for climate factors. Takes regional climate data, elevation, and some regional specific information to give us a good idea of inputs into the watershed. And then ModFlow USG does a great job of letting the alluvial veneer and the stream kind of work together. It lets the unconfined aquifer go dry and then re-wet. It's good for braided streams. And I don't know if the USG fracture component will be suitable for this site or not. It's more of a pipe solution than a fracture plane solution. So we'll have to figure that out after we figure out whether we really need to manage the flow of groundwater in the fractured bedrock or whether we can just treat it once it hits the stream. But certainly be talking to the USGS folks in Tacoma about the site and use of mod flow USGS or USG and PRISM. And that's our goal. I've wandered way too many mountain valleys with a fishing pole in my backpack. And the ones that don't have abandoned mines in them, I usually do pretty well. And the ones where I have no look and I turn a corner and I see a big pile of developmental rock and a big puddle of tailings in the stream, I find a new valley to go walking. So hopefully maybe one day this valley will be worth fishing in. Any questions? Or better yet, any ideas?
Okay, yeah. I see a hand up, so.
Maybe I missed it. You showed the dramatic changes when the dry parts of the mine were wetted by an extreme event.
Right.
How are you going to keep that dry, given that it will probably snow again sometime in the future?
Yeah, well, we've got the bulkhead in the Formosa one at it, and we've got a nice 8-inch pipe coming through it with a gate valve. We didn't have anybody there to open it because it's 3 to 4 foot of snow on the ground. Nobody could get there. So we're going to have to be able to operate that, manage the flow through that bulkhead with some floats, you know, just some really simple stuff for a remote, difficult-to-access site. Doable. Yeah.
Okay. If I don't have any other questions or comments, it's like clear online.
This live broadcast of the characterization and remediation of contaminated groundwater in fractured rock, day one. Remember, this session has been jointly sponsored by the U.S. EPA and the USGS. We're going to come back tomorrow at the same time, starting again at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time, to begin day two. So I'll just remind everyone that the entire session, again, will be available online. So I will encourage you to look for your confirmation or registration reminder email with the instructions to follow us for tomorrow's broadcast. For those of you looking for copies of the presentation material, remember, we have not yet posted that information, although I am working to do that right now in the background. So I hope to have a link for you all by tomorrow where you'll be able to download or access materials. Until then, we do have a copy of this session agenda. You can access that, again, under the related URLs on the middle right of your page. For those of you that are looking for participation certificates, I'll just remind you that you can obtain one of those by completing our online feedback form. So there's a link that you'll see on the middle right under related URLs to something called the seminar feedback form. As long as you complete that online form and indicate that you were present for the entire session or replayed the whole recording, as soon as you send in your feedback, you'll have immediate access to a participation certificate. Anyone can complete that feedback form, so it doesn't matter if you registered individually or you were one in a room full of other people participating under somebody else who signed up. So for those of you who had a group with you in the room, I encourage you to find that link to the feedback form and share that with the others who joined at your location so that they can submit their own feedback to get their own participation certificate. And so with that, I will go ahead and thank the organizers who took time to put on today's session and our presenters, as well as the nearly 80 individuals who signed in throughout today's broadcast to join us for the live session. I'll be back online with you all tomorrow for day two in the characterization and remediation of contaminated groundwater and fractured rock seminar. Thanks so very much for joining us.